We welcome you this morning. We've had a chance to sing together, to pray together, to talk, to remember those who need our prayers, and to remind us of those we need to be mindful of. And so now we're going to have a chance to look at God's Word together. And today we want to talk about the idea of converting people. One of the things that I think that all of us need to be aware of, or are aware of, is that conversion's not always as simple as you see it on TV. I remember when I was quite a bit younger that you would every now and then see a preacher on TV. I'm thinking of like the Billy Graham, where he would come into a town and you would see something like that. And at the end of it, you would see so many people walking down forward, just streaming down the aisles. And then that would be the end of the program, and TV would go on to other things. But it would be nice if things were always that simple and they just ended that way, with everybody just flocking down and you never had anything to follow up after that. But all of us who've been Christians for any time have experienced the heartache of talking with people, working with them, studying with them, trying to reach them, trying to teach them, and doing that, and then having people think about it and say, thank you, but. And then other times they do read, they do study, they do listen, they do follow the gospel, and then they stay for a while and then fall away. And yet some people do stay. Some people do become fully converted. Some people do completely give their lives, their hearts, their minds, their souls to everything that the Lord has said. And they spend the rest of their lifetime in service to God, bringing others also. So conversion can be hard. It can discourage, and yet it can be joyful. But the fact is that even though it's hard, there's still an obligation. There's still a way that God expects us to do. And when he gave us the Great Commission, when he said to go therefore make disciples of all the nations in Matthew chapter 28 in verse 19, he told us exactly kind of what he expected in that. So when we look at that, we ask ourselves, or we can ask ourselves, how did that work in the life of Jesus? And we think about it, that when we look at the four Gospels, at the life of Christ, and we study that, what we realize is that there were times that people did accept him well. There were times that some did, and then there were times that it just didn't work out at all. And at the end of all of that, at the end of all of those 3 years, what we're really left with when we end the Gospels and begin in the first chapter of Acts, we see a small core group who would ultimately form the nucleus of his church and would then branch out from there and then take his gospel and spread it. So the question could be asked, and I mean in a respectful manner to this, not in any kind of sarcastic manner, why didn't Jesus convert more people? What was it that kept people from really responding to his ministry, given that he was the perfect example, given that he was the perfect teacher, he was the perfect Son of God, he was the perfect example for all of us to emulate, to follow as we go out and try to do likewise? And I think as we look at just three quick reasons that for our question of why didn't Jesus convert more people, I think what we're going to really find out is that things aren't a whole lot different today as we go out and try to follow the Great Commission. Because it will work. It can work. The reason we are here as Christians today is because somebody took the Great Commission and taught us, and it's our job to take it and teach others. The reason that this church is here is because it was formed from a nucleus of people who had been taught the gospel of Christ, per the plan of salvation, per the Great Commission, and then they go forward also. So let's just quickly look at three different reasons about why it was that Jesus didn't convert more people. And one of the things that we're going to notice in this here is that when Jesus was teaching people, Jesus, as well as the people, faced huge amount of pressure from the Jewish leaders. The fact is that conversion has always been greatly affected by those who are the established religious authorities of any day and of any age in which the teaching is concerned. Now, that religious thought, those religious authorities, those religious leanings of an area may be different from one state to another, from one city to another, from one part of the world to another, or from one age to another. But the fact is that there's always prevailing religious authorities in any age, in any place like that. I want to notice over in John chapter 9, John chapter 9, where we want to see what happened when Jesus healed a blind man, and notice the great effect that was exerted by the religious authorities of that day and of that time. When we look at John chapter 9, notice that John chapter 9, verse 1 begins, says, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from his birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Now Jesus answered, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And when he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. So there Jesus healed a blind man. There's no doubt about what he did. The man was evidence of that because he went blind and came back where he could see. So this led to a lot of questions. This gained a lot of notoriety, which could have warranted a huge amount of conversions. But nothing's ever that simple when you're dealing around religious authorities who really don't buy into what's being taught. He said, therefore, then verse 8, the neighbors and those who had previously had seen that he was blind said, is this not he who sat and begged? Some said, this is he. Others said, he is like him. He said, I am he. So they even got into a discussion on who the fellow was. Well, this was the fellow. No, he's somebody that looks just like him. And finally, the guy had to interject and say, no, I really am the fellow that was blind. Now, when the man, the healed man, he was hauled in before the leaders at the time. It says, verse 13, they brought him who was formerly blind to the Pharisees. Now, it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees asked him again how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put clay in my eyes, and I washed, and I see. Now the man should have known he was there. Even though he was blind at the time, he could very well, good and well, tell what was being done to him at the time to enable him to see. Therefore, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such things? And there was much division among them. So now there couldn't be any division about whether or not the man was healed or not because he's standing there and he's able to see, he's able to explain it, but there's a huge amount of division over how he was healed and who, and whether or not he was healed by someone who was a sinner or from God. So in verse 17, they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him? Because he opened your eyes. He said, he is a prophet. But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. So now they're going to bring other people into this event. They're going to ask other people about this. And the people that they bring in are the man's parents. So they asked him about it, and they said, first of all, in verse 19, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he see? Well, now, there's going to be a test right there for him. As parents, they're going to be loyal to their son. They're going to try to be loyal to their family because that's where parents are pulled. But in this case here, they've got an opposite pull on them that's going to tear them in half almost on who they're going to be loyal to and what they're going to do. Because when they ask their parents, his parents about it, they say, "We know that this was our son." Now that's a fact that can't be denied. It doesn't even take any belief or loyalty on their part. That's just a physical fact. They're his parents. He said, "And that he was born blind." That's a physical fact. It's not a matter of judgment. It's not a matter of doctrine. It's not a matter of a belief. It's just a fact. He was born blind. But now notice verse 21, where now all of a sudden the parents are starting to be affected by the pressure of the religious leadership and the prevailing thought at the time. They said, "By what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age, ask him, he will speak for himself." So they basically kind of brushed their hands away from it. Even though Jesus had taken their beloved son and healed him, they're not willing to go to bat for Jesus. And you say, what is it that could cause parents to feel that kind of pressure where fundamentally they're going to turn their back on their son and not completely support him along with the person who made their son well? Most parents would be extremely loyal to doctors who could take their son or their daughter, their precious child, and make them well. Most parents would be very loyal to a hospital or to a treatment center that could take their child and make them well. And verse 22 explains this. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already, if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. In other words, there was fear that they had because of the decision that was made. If anybody defended Jesus, out they went and they were gone from there and didn't have any more fellowship with that Jews. And that was just deadly to the Jews, to their ideas at the time. So they wouldn't do it. Therefore, in verse 23, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." So they just bravely backed out of the picture of it and turned, and that was all the influence they were going to exert on it. They weren't even going to give credit to the fellow that healed their son. They weren't going to give credit to Jesus on that. So what do the people do now? In verse 24, they call again the man who was born blind and said to him, "Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner." And the man says, "Whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, though, that though I was blind, now I see." So they ask him, how did he do this? And they said, "Well, I told you once. Do I have to keep telling you about it?" And they revile him and say, "You're a disciple, and we are Moses' disciples. But we know about Moses, but we don't know where he's from." And the man says, "Well, this is a marvelous thing that you did not know where he's from, yet he has opened my eyes. Now, we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a sinner of God and does his will, he hears him." And so he says that this is just an incredible miracle that's been unheard of before. In verse 33, his conclusion was, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And so then they turn on him and accuse him of being born in sins, and he got cast out in verse 34. Now, there's all sorts of pressure going on here to keep people from acknowledging who Jesus was and what he did. There's this huge amount of pressure from the temple leaders who are looking at the parents and pressuring them to not acknowledge him. They're looking at the fellow. The parents didn't deny the healing, but they said, how I did it, we don't know, and we don't know about anything else about it. So they didn't get cast out. Their son did get cast out. They let him get cast out of it. And it ended up with a discussion from the Jews about whether or not they were blind. Now, there's all sorts of pressure here, and that faced anybody that would testify to Jesus. The leadership at the time wasn't going to let it be let Jesus be testified or be taught or supported in any manner that they could defend. They would even turn on each other. When you look in John chapter 7, in verse 45, when we see the officers and the chief priests and Pharisees coming together, there was a fellow named Nicodemus who was part of this. And they asked the soldiers why they didn't bring Jesus back. He said in John 7, 46, no man ever spoke like this man. So then the Pharisees answered them, are you also deceived? But then Nicodemus, in verse 50, he who came to Jesus by night, this is the same fellow that you read about in John chapter 3. He just asked a simple question about, shouldn't we basically talk to him first? Shouldn't we hear him first? And does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he's doing? And they answered and said to him, are you also from Galilee? Search and look, for no prophet is risen out of Galilee. So first of all, there's peer pressure on anybody else in their leadership group to make sure they toe the line. And they'll even turn on each other and force each other back in line when somebody wants to do something as simple as, well, shouldn't we bring them in and talk to them about what the law has to say? And then there's pressure on the people who are trying to acknowledge the miracles and who are trying to understand them. And what that's going to do is that's going to lead to all sorts of confusion. When Jesus was working with the people in Jerusalem at one of the feasts there, what you have is, if you look in John chapter 7 in verse 40, therefore many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, truly, this is the prophet. Others said, this is the Christ. But some said, will the Christ come out of Galilee? Has not the scriptures said that Christ comes from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem where David was? And then in verse 43, it says, so there was a division among the people because of him. Now, some of them wanted to take him, but no one laid hold on him or laid hands on him. So now they're divided over things, and they don't know whether to argue about it by doctrine. They don't know whether to argue about it by deeds. They just flat don't know how to deal with it. But what we can see is there's huge pushback on this. Now, I'm not a fisherman. I'm not really the son of a great fisherman. Not really into fishing or know anything about it, hardly at all, if anything whatsoever, almost probably nothing. But I know this. If you've got a good fishing hole and you're sitting on the bank of the river, casting in, just pulling in those fellows right and left, and I'm standing on the back of the bank, every now and then I start kicking dirt clods because I get bored since I'm not a fisherman, and I start chunking rocks down in the water where you're trying to fish. And then I start taking big gobs of dirt and tossing over your shoulder into the water where you're trying to fish. And now I've got the water stirred up where it's frothy, and I've got full of mud, and I've just made a lot of noise. And then I finally turn the radio on real loud or start singing or humming or yelling or hollering. And then finally I take a stick, a big long branch off of a tree, and I start going down where you're trying to fish there, and I start stirring that water. I know this. I may not know how to catch a fish, and it may have been, and I don't know how many decades ago it was a bunch of those fellas. And the last fish I caught was about yay big or something like that, and who knows when that was or where or how. But I know this. I may not know anything about fishing, but if I'm stirring the water and muddying it that much and just keeping it churned up with enough commotion, you're not going to catch any fish either. Now, the Jewish leaders didn't have to meet Jesus face to face to shut down some of his chances of converting. But they could make their pressure felt. But they could keep the water stirred up enough. They could keep enough doubt going. They could keep enough confusion going. They could keep enough fear going. That's all they had to do was to stop a lot of the people otherwise who would have given Jesus serious attention. Because the fact is that deciding to become a follower of Jesus takes the decision that a person's going to break away from the effective leadership, that a person's going to break away from that heritage if it's wrong, that a person's going to break away from those teachers if they're wrong, that a person's going to break away from doctrines and practices and accept new ones in their place if the Word of God teaches it. And so what these Jewish leaders did was exerted every kind of pressure that they had, that they could, on the people. They may not have the answers to what Jesus had. There was no way to explain it. To the fact is that Jesus had to have been of God to have healed the blind man. No way out of it. But all they had to do was, today we would call it fear, uncertainty, and doubt. All they'd have to do was churn the water enough and put enough chunks of mud into it, put enough stones into it, stir it with a stick enough, and make enough hoops and hollers to keep the fish away, and there would be a lot less people who would give Jesus the time and the attention. It's always been that way. If you look over in Matthew chapter 19, verse 29, and everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life. And many who are first will be last, and the last first. But let me tell you, it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of thought. It takes an absolute huge amount of strength to make that kind of choice when there's so much commotion and confrontation being stirred about by existing thought and leaders. And it's that way today. The leaders change from generation to generation. Thought changes from generation to generation, but it's always a headwind when you're trying to work with those who think differently and who are in established leadership positions. But something else that Jesus did that affected the amount of people that would decide to follow him was he didn't offer his followers any kind of worldly benefits that people like so much. You look on this over in John chapter 6. When you look in John chapter 6, you find Jesus was teaching a good multitude, and preachers generally like that, to look out and see they've got a house full of people. Or in this case here in John chapter 6, he's to see a field full of people or wherever they are. Because in John chapter 6, verse 1 and 2 says, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Then a great multitude followed him because they saw his signs, which he performed on those who were diseased. So here's this huge crowd following Jesus. And that would warm a preacher's heart big time on that. So Jesus looks at them and he sees the great multitude coming to him in verse 5. So he says to Philip, where shall we buy bread that these may eat? So he's going to feed them. Now they get into discussion about this huge crowd. But in verse 10, Jesus said, make the people sit down. And there was about, and then now the place, there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number about 5,000 people there. And Jesus basically fed them with 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish that are mentioned in verse 9. And then when it was all over, in verse 12, he tells his disciples to go gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing's lost. And they filled, in verse 13, 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. Now, when he did that great event, I want to notice just how tremendous the response was. The people understood that, so they said in verse 14, this is truly the prophet who has come into the world. Now, that's good. That's a positive reception. And then in verse 15, it's such a positive reception that the people were get about ready by force to make him king. This idea that Jesus was constantly rebuked or was pushed away by the people isn't always true. In this case here, they wanted to make him king. Now, normally that would be a good thing, but that's not here because Jesus knows their motive and he completely rejects it. He sends them away. He leaves. He's not going to have any part of that. But this discussion isn't over, because later on in verse 26, Jesus sees him again after they find him when he's somewhere else, because now they go out and make it a point to look for him and try to find him. And you would think, well, that was good. Preacher ought to like that. But he says in verse 26, most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. In other words, they want food. They found a fellow that could give them food. So they said, okay, this is a good thing. We'll keep following them. But he said, that's not good enough. And he tells them in verse 27, don't labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which is endured. So now he says there's two kinds of food. There's the food that perishes, and then there's the food that endures. Now, what are you going to do here? What are they going to follow? They've got a choice to make, and he's going to help them in that choice. Even though the choice is going to tell us what we need to know for this sermon, he's basically working with these folks that want more food. Now, he's just fed 5,000 of them the previous day or so, and so they look for him in verse 30 again, though, and they say, well, what sign will you perform then that we may see it and believe you? In other words, the food that you did a day or two ago, feeding 5,000, isn't enough anymore. We want more. We want to see another sign. That's another way to say feed us again. And notice now they try to bring scripture into it in verse 31. Your fathers ate the manna in the desert, as it is written, he gave them food from heaven to eat. So we want the same thing they had. And Jesus said, most assuredly I say unto you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven. Yeah, he can't deny that they had food in the wilderness, but he's saying this is not the bread from heaven that we're talking about. But my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. So in verse 34, they said, well, Lord, give us this bread always, always. In other words, they're just hooked into this thing. They want more of this, and they want a continuous supply on it. They want a food chain going. So Jesus tried to explain to them that he was the bread of life in verse 35. But he's telling them, but I said to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. Now what's going to go on? He teaches them a little bit more. Now look in verse 41. The Jews then complained about him because he said, I am the bread which came down from heaven. Now here's a fella that just fed 5,000 people from just almost nothing, and now they're complaining about him. Now, why would they do that? Well, because there is not one shred of spiritual logic in their minds right now. Because they're so captured by the physical aspect, they can't even see, they don't even want, they don't understand, they're not going to have anything to do with the spiritual application of what he's trying to do on that. So what happens on this? What happens on it is they leave. In verse 60, therefore many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can understand it? And look in verse 66. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. Then there's a sad note in verse 67. Then Jesus said to the 12, do you also want to go away? So Jesus looked out, and here's this massive group of people that had followed him, and they just slowly frittered away because they were upset about it, because he wouldn't keep feeding them. Finally, he's back to the original group that he had, and he says, do you guys want to leave too? Now, Simon Peter said the right thing. In verse 68, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. Now, the fact is that Jesus didn't take his ministry and promise people everything they needed. What they wanted was what you see today, with everybody setting up social things and physical things, food chains, food courts, everything else. All sorts of food programs for services. And the fact is that if you do that, you will get a huge crowd. But as soon as you quit doing that, your crowd's going to leave. Now, I'm not making fun of people who are hungry. I'm not telling you that it's not important if your neighbor's not hungering. or if your neighbor doesn't have anything to eat, that I'm not telling you not to go over and work with them, because now that's part of what you need to be doing and what I need to be doing, what we all need to be doing as Christians. I understand that, and you do too. But I'm saying the reason these people left Jesus was because there wasn't any spiritual logic in that whatsoever to them. All they wanted was the food. And Jesus made it very clear in his ministry that when people followed him, they needed to understand that this was a spiritual decision. It was a spiritual decision that they were doing, that they were going to do it to be right with God. They were going to be doing it to follow the commandments of God, and it wasn't going to be because they were going to be receiving anything physical from it. It would cost them rather than give them all sorts of things of the world. And the last thing we want to notice real quickly is that the followers of Jesus sometimes interfered with what Jesus was doing, because they needed time to grow, they needed time to develop, they needed time to become spiritual, just like Jesus was, and they needed time to do this developing. We see a little bit of this in Mark chapter 9. And in Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 14, you see where Jesus and a handful of apostles come down from the Mount of Transfiguration. And verse 14 says, when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. In other words, you come down there and what he's going to come into is just a big argument. A big argument with a big crowd, and right in the middle of it are his disciples, and right in the middle of it is a man who's saying, I brought my son and you folks couldn't heal him. Your guys couldn't do that. Now that was a serious hit to the ministry of Jesus, because the whole idea of being able to heal was to show that God was with them and they had the power and the approval of God. And when miracles failed, it could really be looked on, something's wrong here with this whole situation that they're trying to do. So what Jesus did was, first of all, he worked on the Father, because the Father wasn't getting it. And the Father was down there in that big crowd mixing up with the scribes and with all the followers of Jesus who were still down there. And you know, that's like every big crowd and big argument today. I have never seen any kind of light, any kind of good thing, any kind of information, any kind of insight come out of a big crowd and a big argument where everybody's arguing with each other. There's just nothing comes out of that that's good in any way, shape, form, or fashion. So Jesus could only start working with the people finally when he broke up that foolishness and got them in where he could work with them and talk with them. So he's talking with the Father now, and the Father isn't quite getting it. So in verse 21, Jesus is just trying to talk to the guy one-on-one. He says, how long has this been happening? He says, from childhood. He explains it to him in verse 22. But then in verse 22, he says, if you can do anything to Jesus. And Jesus fires it right back at him and says, if you can believe, all things are possible. The man got it. And in verse 24, he says, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. So Jesus healed his son. But that's not the only group that he worked with, because in verse 28, his disciples appear to be kind of shook up with this, because they had something that didn't go together right. And they looked at him and said, why could we not cast it out? And Jesus, basically, it says, this kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. In other words, you've been so involved with your business, you've been so involved with the commotion going on, you've been so involved with everything out here putting this together, that you haven't been praying enough and you haven't been fasting enough. In other words, this is some of this spiritual insight thing that we've been talking about that wasn't in the crowd of the food. You can get so involved with the mechanics of something that you don't stop and think about the spirituality of something. He's trying to explain him to that. And he says, you've been doing this part, but you haven't been doing the other side. It can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. And just put it right back on them on that. Now they got it. And I realize that they had to have a time of growth there. And they were developing. And we need to realize that when we are looking at the time in the life of Christ, that we're looking at a time when his followers were developing as followers on that, because they didn't always shine that light like they were supposed to. Over in Luke chapter 9, you see three very quick things that they did. In Luke chapter 9, beginning about verse 46, says, then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. So they're working together, and while they're all together, they get in a big fight with each other, big argument with each other about which one's going to be the greatest. And Jesus, that's when he took a little child and said, whoever receives this little child in my name receives me. And he makes a lesson from the child, for he who is least among you will be the greatest. So the first thing they were doing, they were losing their unity as a group because they were arguing about it. And then in verse 49, John, you can see John kind of strutting and kind of proud on this. He says, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us. Well, what John was forgetting on this thing, that when you look at the life of Christ through those 3 years, Jesus wasn't always working with those people one-on-one 100% of the time. There were times he was with them. There was times he wasn't with them. There was times they were doing things. There was times he was with different one of them. And there could easily have been other people doing things in his name, good works, that they might not know about because they weren't in the lead role like they would be later on in the time of the churches. And so Jesus said, do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is on our side. So they hadn't realized that their world was a little bit bigger than they were. That was the second thing that kind of hindered him. And then you get into the third, following verse 51, where they're now into verse 52, they're in a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him, but the people there didn't receive him. And so now this is what James and John do. They saw this to say, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did? Well, they're proud of that. They got an idea there. They didn't receive us. Let's just burn them up. Let's just bring fire down on them. And that sounds good at first. But what that does says they're looking at this as a one and done rule. What that does is removes any chance of them being saved later on. Later on, when Philip in Acts 8 starts heading up to Samaria, if they had burned that village up, that village wouldn't have been there to receive the gospel from Philip or from the other preachers when they dispersed out of Jerusalem after the killing. When they scattered, when Saul started chasing them all out, that village wouldn't have been there. So Jesus said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And they went to another village. When we think of these three things, what we see is that things really aren't a whole lot different. These same three areas can affect the church today. They can affect our lives today. They can affect our work. Nothing's really a whole lot different on that. Because when it comes down to it, all we can do is really work. And when we get discouraged, we just need to work a little bit harder. We need to give ourselves a little bit more to prayer and to things of a spiritual nature, and we need to go out and keep working. And sometimes it'll work against us, and sometimes it'll work for us. But as people keep doing the things of God His way, and as long as they're right about those things of doing the things of God His way, it'll be right with the work of the Lord over time. Again, this church is here because people in the past did those things, and they spread the gospel, and they talked to good and honest hearts who received the gospel, who obeyed the gospel, and who passed it on to others. And we're living and breathing Christians as a testimony to previous people in the past who have just kept on plugging away, doing things God's way because they were interested in doing things of God. yeah, Jesus could have converted a whole lot more in a perfect world, but it wasn't his fault. It was because the world was being the world. And they were making things cloudy, and they were just making things fussy, and they were being less than perfect. And it's just always been that way. So what we have to do when we look at these applications ourselves, we have to ask ourselves, do the things of Jesus, the things that he taught, the things that he promised, the things that he commanded, the blessings that he said would be awaiting us in heaven, do those things attract us? And that's what we have to look for. That's what we have to wait for. That's what we have to hope for, because that's what's in front of us. And that's what Jesus was trying to get across to the people in the New Testament. And it's a testimony to the power of God that even though he was working in that imperfect world with all those imperfect religious leaders, with the imperfect people who were his followers, he was still able to establish the Lord's church, which still exists some 2,000 years later and still preaches the same message and still asks people to obey the same gospel. And that's all that we can offer you today. We can't offer you a lick more than what Jesus taught us in the New Testament. We just can't do that. Because when people do that, they lose sight of what Jesus really wanted people to focus on and to obey and do. If that attracts you in any way to become a Christian, we'll be glad to help you become a Christian today by taking you and baptizing you in the name of Jesus for the remission of your sins. If you need to be restored to the service of God, having fallen off that way from being in it once, let us know, because the gospel calls you today, even now, as we stand and as we sing.